You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a bright, beautiful, sunny Davis day. But you know, Don, 2 minutes ago, the wind just whipped up. It was pretty amazing. It was nice and calm for a while.
Yeah, so we have a red flag warning, in fact, because of the wind in effect right now. Temperature, I've got it back up here. It is June 10th, 2026, as Lois and I are preparing this for broadcast on June 11, 2026. And our weather station here is showing a red flag warning. We're going to have north wind for the next day, actually day and a half into Thursday, and then high pressure is building. This is a really interesting high pressure ridge or dome, whatever you want to call it. It's building over the North Pacific. And so it's going to move in over the Pacific Northwest in a big way, Washington, Oregon, and push down into Northern California. So I've been watching for the last couple of days as they've been talking about 99, 103, 102 for us, because we're kind of on the edge of this large thing up in Portland and Seattle. This is going to be pretty uncomfortable. But notably, this is, I believe, our first triple digit projected temperature for the season, with a probable high the day of the broadcast, at least looking at the University Airport site of the National Weather Service, of 102 degrees. I think Weather Underground is saying 103. And then notable tonight, Wednesday night, so before the broadcast, our low is only going to be 71, which is unusual for us. Usually our lows are way down in the low 60s or even into the 50s. So that's going to be a little uncomfortable. Thursday night, 61 degrees, not 71. So 71 on Wednesday night, 61 on Thursday night, Friday, 100 degrees, Friday night, 59, Saturday, cooling to 97, Saturday night, 58, Sunday, 94 degrees, sunny throughout, no clouds in any of this for us. Sunday night will be 57, Monday, 95, which is a little above average for this time of year, Monday night, 57, and Tuesday, 94 degrees. So our first little spell of very hot weather, and people have been talking about it a lot because, well, the red flag warning, first of all, this dry wind is going to be a garden factor. But again, we're hitting 100 degrees. So those of you that live in far west Davis and far north Davis, where those really annoying midges have been biting you, this is what kills them. So good news for you. 100 degrees plus for a couple of days kills off the no-see-ums that are so uncomfortable for those on the edge of town, the west and north part of town. More to the point, from a gardening standpoint, the evapotranspiration rate for the next 4 days is going to be substantially higher than it's been for several weeks. So if you've been barely watering enough, it won't be enough for the next few days. I happened to turn on my vegetable garden yesterday. I was going to run it for an hour, and I forgot, and I went to work. So it ran all day. So my vegetable garden got a really thorough soaking. And I'm at work at about 2 p.m, realizing what I had done and thinking, oh, well. Then I looked at the weather. I thought, perfect. I couldn't have planned that better. A really deep soaking for the vegetable garden and the trees and things nearby is very appropriate. I would love for you all to go out listening to this broadcast on Thursday with the, you know, extreme heat coming in right after some wind. Be aware that plants could be very, very drought stressed by the low humidity and the wind significantly increasing the ET rate. Be a great time to give a much longer soaking than you're thinking of. I know a lot of you have moved over gradually to doing longer and longer soakings because we hammer on it so hard on the Davis Garden Show so much, but we still are having the daily conversations of a drip system running 10 minutes three times a week, or even 5 minutes every day or something like that. You should probably run it, if it's on your vegetable garden, flower garden, shallower rooted plants, an hour and a half to 2 hours would be great right now. because that would get a 1 foot depth of irrigation with a typical drip system. Okay.
And that would be something you'd want to do every week, wouldn't it?
For flowers and vegetables, probably twice a week. For woody plants, I'd rather have you do it even longer, but once a week, depending on your soil. So we, you know, we go over those parameters a lot. It depends on how well your soil retains moisture. Those of you with raised vegetable planters, this is going to be a stressful 3 to 4 days. I'm guessing you should probably run your system every day during this windy hot spell in a raised planter, especially if you filled it with purchased topsoil that's probably rather sandy. You can check the soil, but you won't hurt the plant by running it every day right now. It will be really hard to overwater a plant in a fast draining soil during a heat wave or heat event. I should say this isn't really a heat wave, but a heat event like this. So I know, staff, we've already been talking about this. For the next week to 2 weeks, we're going to be looking at leaves with withered edges and this, you know, burnt surfaces and so forth because of inadequate irrigation. Obviously, we talk about that a lot here, so we'll move on for the moment. But good time to go out and do a really good soaking. A couple of events first. Let's see. Davis Music Fest is happening. That's a big deal in Davis.
Well, wait a minute. Happening when? It's not now.
June 19 to 21. So, oh, yeah, we're 9 days out. And KDRT is there. KDRT attends and broadcasts from there, and they do remote reporting and all that kind of thing. This started in 2011. It's a big fundraiser for arts and music education in the Davis Public Schools. There are 41 bands. This is, we're talking about a town with a very compact downtown. For those of you outside the area, Davis, for a town of 70,000, the downtown is pretty darn tight. And there are going to be 41 bands across a wide range of genres performing on 9 different stages over 3 days. So every type of music. I mean, I read through some of the names. I recognize some of them. I look at the different styles, a lot of folk, a lot of indie rock, all that kind of stuff. You can purchase tickets and wristbands to get you into the different events. Just go to davismusicfest.com. It's a big deal for KDRT and Davis Media Access to participate in this. You'll see our programmers out there at different venues broadcasting from the site. So check it out, Davis Music Fest. More information next week's show. That's coming up June 19 to 21. I was interested to see a behind-the-scenes tour on campus at the Good Life Garden. I don't think most people know about this garden.
I certainly didn't.
You didn't? It's in the courtyard of the Robert Mondavi Institute. Can't miss that. That's a big old building visible from the freeway right there on the west end of, well, southwest edge of campus. Has its own off-ramp on the freeway. They are calling all edible gardening enthusiasts. Join landscape adaptation fellow J.R. Balangasa for a tour of the Good Life Garden in the Mondavi Institute courtyard. The garden features raised beds with vegetables, fruit trees, ornamental plantings that support pollinators and biodiversity. You can visit this relaxing and colorful garden just as summer gets underway and learn about the many crops that we can grow in our climate. Pre-registration is not required, but please arrive on time to the meeting location. You are encouraged to wear comfortable walking shoes. Consider bringing a water bottle. The event will be canceled in the case of an extreme heat event, but this is Wednesday, June 17th, 12:10 to 1 p.m. And I would suggest going to arboretum.ucdavis.edu. Click on the events link. There's a map that shows the directions to where the courtyard is at Robert Mondavi Institute. Go behind the scenes of the Good Life Garden, Wednesday, June 17th at 12:10 p.m.
So I wanted to ask you about a few things. We've got some hot weather coming. This is the first time we've been over 100 this year, isn't it, Don?
Yep.
Okay. And it's going to be a couple of days of hot. So I pulled up from Don's website, from his archives, an article he wrote quite a while ago. It's called Hot Weather in the Garden. And it talks about things, but it's not, how shall I put that? It's still relevant, even though the information is a little bit old. And the part I wanted to...
Where did I write this? 2020. It's not that old. Okay, yeah.
Well, 6 years.
Yeah.
By the way, just so the listeners know, Don has been busy. He has put every single Davis Enterprise article he's written since he started writing for them a long time ago up on the website. And there's a list that you can go to. You could just see everything. So, Don, how do we get to that list? We go to your website, redwoodbarn.com.
Yep. And you look over on the left-hand corner, it says website links. And there it is.
And there it is, yeah.
It's everything I could find. I might have missed a few, but, you know, yeah. I'll go through my folders and see if I find and the older ones.
When you get there, understand this is a double alphabet. Yeah. So the first alphabet is articles that he wrote that he did not publish in the Enterprise. And then below that, there's a list of all the Davis Enterprise articles. That's actually a much longer list. So double alphabet. Look for the word hot in the second alphabet, and you will find this article. You can read the whole thing because it's really long. But let's start with direct physiological effects of high temperatures.
Well, someone walked into my nursery just the other day. So we hadn't even had this heat wave yet. But we had a fairly dry wind. We've been going up and down recently. We haven't had the high temperatures, but we have had windy spells followed by, you know, rainstorms every week or two, seemingly. It's a lot of fungus problems. But he came in with tomato leaves that were looking a little burnished and some flecking on them. And here's the main thing, a little withering on the edges and the tip of the leaf. So I was able to tell him that the other part looked like thrips damage, but that part was pretty clearly inadequate water on one day. This is what's hard to explain. They go, but I'm watering. I said, yes, I know. But I'm watering every day. Yes, I know. But on one particular day when it was dry and windy, and we actually had a humidity below 10% with a wind coming in, he didn't have enough water on them just that day. And it probably your system came on that night or the next morning and, you know, took care of the deficiency of soil moisture, but you had a little injury from a day of drying. Well, I fully expect to see a lot more of that after 1.5 days of north wind and 3 days of higher temperatures. Even if we don't get over 100, that combination of relatively high temperatures and dry wind is going to lead to certain symptoms. And especially we'll see it on those vigorous, vegetative, succulent, soft leaves of things that are growing so happily in your vegetable garden. These are plants that have not yet experienced dry, hot wind to any significant degree yet, except that brief episode. And so you'll see some of the leaves looking a little rough. But the other thing that you'll find is that the flowers of some of these plants won't pollinate during these high temperature periods. So your tomatoes, if they look like mine, are growing. They're halfway up the cage. There's lots of flowers and buds on them. A lot of those flowers will simply fall off. They won't pollinate when it's close to 100 degrees. So one of the most immediate physiological effects of high temperatures in the vegetable garden is lack of pollination during those time periods. So the high temperature on a day being above 90 to 95, hitting 100 plus, almost all of those I mentioned, tomatoes, some peppers, cucumbers, beans, squash plants will probably just stop pollinating. So those flowers will form and just fall off. There's plenty of time. Don't worry. There's plenty more time available for them to pollinate.
And the flowers that had pollinated and set fruit beforehand, are they going to fall off too?
No, they should be fine. So it's actually an impact on the pollination process itself. In the years I've lived here, I've actually had 3 summers when we had extreme heat, when my corn was blooming, you know, the tassels were forming, you could see the pollen, and it just didn't take. It didn't, you know, the pollen tubes don't develop when it's extremely hot, and especially when it's extremely dry. So the combination of high temperature and low humidity can really affect pollination. It literally is a direct impact on the pollination process itself. But the one that's already set should be fine. As long as it's getting the watering it needs, that fruit should expand. Everything should be okay. So
when the fruit is still small, so wouldn't expect that you'd see, like if you had a ripe pepper, mm-hmm. and then it got sun, you could get that burn on the side of it, but you wouldn't see that on the little young ones, would you?
No, typically not. That happens as the fruit ripens because the waxy cuticle begins to thin out as the fruit ripens, making it more vulnerable to sunburn. So that's number two on the list of direct physiological effects of high temperatures. Fruit of tomatoes and peppers that is exposed to direct afternoon sun, like the west side of the plant, may sunburn. We call it sun scald. And that damaged portion can just be cut off. The fruit isn't rotten or anything bad, but it's scorched and it will spoil from that point if you don't do something. So,
and that's it. But we aren't in that situation today because we don't have ripe fruit.
Very few people have ripe fruit. So we're not too worried
about
that.
Hey, Don, you got any ripe fruit out there?
Yeah, I just picked 4 tomatoes, believe it or not.
He is gloating so much. It's June and he picked ripe tomatoes. Yeah. Okay, what variety were they?
Vivacious and 4th of July are the two that I picked first. They're both relatively small fruited, 3 to 4 ounce fruit, and they're ripe. So that's,
All right. Well,
The other thing is that you can shade the plants to protect the fruit from sun scald, but the more you shade your summer vegetables, the less they'll produce. So, you know, you have this trade-off. The simplest thing I've seen, just for the record, you might want to get started on this now since we'll probably have more heat events. Right. So rather than an overhead structure, one of the simplest things you can do is just put some stakes in the ground, put a panel of shade cloth, or really anything, but shade cloth is perhaps simplest, to the west. You know, it's going to be 6 feet high or 8 feet. 6 feet is probably reasonable. And that, from about 2 or 3 o'clock on, if you position it right, will cast a shadow over that plant and reduce the likelihood of sunburn on the fruit. I get concerned when I see people putting shade cloth over their garden, their whole vegetable garden. Yeah, the plants are fine with it. They tend to grow lush, but I can tell you it will reduce your yield. So that's the trade-off there. Drought stress will increase the likelihood of sun scald on both the fruit and the leaves. So we do get sunburn on the leaves. So make sure you're watering correctly. I mean, and we talk about that enough. I think you've all got the message on that one. Good time right now to water your vegetable garden. A lot of our lawn grasses will start to go into a sort of a funny summer, I won't call it dormancy, but when it gets hot, fescues in particular, which have become very popular turf grasses, will start to shed some of the outer leaves on that particular clump of grass. If you look closely at a fescue turf, it's actually very close together clumps. It's not a running grass like Bermuda grass, it's a clumping grass. And on the edges, the older leaves will just start to yellow, get a little straw colored, and the overall appearance of the turf can get more dull or less vivid green than what most people seem to expect their turf to be. So don't be too surprised if you see that happen on your lawn. It's not really anything to worry about, but don't mow them when it's hot. That's really the key thing there. Mowing any grass when you're going to be over 95 degrees is stressful to the turf. Your direct sun is going to be getting down into the growing point and can wither it. In particular, it can cause thinning of the turf really badly, and fescues have a high growing point. So if you mow them short when it's high temperature, they're really going to thin out badly. That's really the only thing that goes wrong with fescue turf grasses in our area, and they are the most common turf grasses people are using, is that they can thin out really abruptly and rather unattractively if you mow them short in high temperature periods. So just wait till we're out of the heat wave to mow. If you got someone coming on Thursday, maybe have them reschedule. Just tell them you'll pay them anyway. Come on back next week, get it taken care of then. So
even when it's not hot, don't mow them short, because the shorter you mow it, the more likely you are to cut off some growing points.
Yeah, a gold rule of thumb is never cut off more than 1/3 of the leaf blade at a time. But really, in the case of fescue, if you're interested in this kind of thing, get down on your hands and knees there, pull up an individual grass clump, and look where it's growing. And the growing point of fescue is about 1.5 to 2 inches up out of the ground. Mm-hmm. Whereas for bluegrass, it's maybe 1/2 inch out of the ground. Well, fescues are great. They like our heat. They're okay with a little drought and so forth. They're great choices for the valley. But if you mow that to 1.5 inches, then it's going to be 100 degrees and 10% humidity. Many of those growing points are those individual grass plants. Your lawn is a giant population of individual grass plants. Many of them will just wither. And that particular plant will yellow, brown, or even die. And so if you stand and look at a drought-stressed, suddenly mowed lawn in the middle of the summer, it can look pretty rough. Better to let it grow out a little bit, go another few days, mow when it's cooler. I understand your gardening service may not be able to adapt to that. So at the very least, right after they mow it, turn on your sprinklers and give it a good soaking so that you can reduce the desiccation from the wind. Also, this is probably the best time right now to start deep soakings on some of the trees. I'm doing it on my property as we speak. I've got water running on a long stretch that I have that's mostly maples and got some clumping bamboos. These are relatively high water plants. I'm giving them a really thorough soaking today. Plants can be harmed or die from lack of water during protracted periods of heat, but most commonly what we see is the leaves just wither or scorch, and the pattern varies from one type to another. Thin-leafed trees like Japanese maples, if they were in full sun and were drought-stressed, the whole leaf will wither, but along the edges first. Others like citrus, which are pretty drought-tolerant, but if they're under-irrigated and subjected to extreme heat, the leaves will scorch. They'll look literally sunburned, and they'll scorch in a pattern that reflects the direction the leaf was pointing. I can go, hey, this leaf was facing southwest. How did you know that? That's magical. Yes, I'm a wizard. No, it faces the hottest sun of the day, and that's the part that burned. So right now, good time to deep water your citrus in particular, but also I just mention them because so many people have them. But your maples and some of the other higher water trees like that would also definitely benefit from an irrigation. And check and make sure you're watering the whole root zone. We've talked about how the roots go well past the drip line of the tree. Be a good time to just water the whole thing. And today, as you're listening to the show, would be good. If you can't get to it till after the heat wave, you know, you might experience a little bit of sunburn on the leaves. I prefer personally to water going into heat than coming out, than in the middle of it. But whatever it takes to avoid drought stress would be kind of important. So if you don't feel like putting together a system or checking your whole line, I've had this conversation more than once, you know, your redwoods are stressed and other plants don't seem to need the special attention, you can go to CVS Pharmacy, places like that that have funny little gardening sections. You'll find a cheap soaker hose. You can hook it up to your garden hose, squiggle it around more or less the drip line of the tree, turn it on until it's dripping, and let it run for several hours. That's one way to deal with it. I mean, when I suggest bypassing your system, some people look kind of aghast, but it makes it simpler. You've got one group of trees that need some extra water. Give some extra water to those trees. Newly planted trees need a really thorough soaking about once a week. And by newly planted, I mean with a couple of months ago, at least. Newly planted as in this week, check daily water as needed.
So Don, thank you for sending me this article with the picture. I have never seen a picture of a glassy wing sharpshooter before.
Yeah.
It's not terribly ugly as a critter goes. But tell me what's going on. I know that we had... It was Costco that got a shipment of things that were contaminated?
Costco received multiple shipments of grapevines that were infested with the glassy wing sharpshooter, which spreads a particular disease, a Pierce's disease, to grapevines and is very, very, very destructive to grapevines. Obviously, the wine industry, the wine grape industry, is the most concerned about this. And the Napa Costco, for example, received 220 grapevines from the nursery in question. And the Ag Commissioner is all over Northern California. I've got to give credit to whoever organized this, every Ag Commissioner, every extension office. I mean, everybody that I can think of that's tangentially related to agricultural and horticultural issues posted this on Facebook and every other form of social media, alerting everybody to this particular pest problem. So to their credit, there's been a lot of information out there for the public. The key thing on this is they're still looking for them in some cases. And
they're still looking for the bugs or for the plants?
They're still looking for both. So, for example, of the 220 that were shipped to Costco in Napa, the city in Napa County, probably the most important wine producing county in the United States, they've recovered 101 of the 220. So one of the reasons that we're all licensed in the nursery business is if something like this comes up, they have a record of where every nursery is, and they can go to a company like the nursery that shipped these, and they know where they were shipped to. Costco, if it sells plants, they have a nursery license. Anyone that sells plants has a nursery license. This is why. So they could do a paper trail. And now they're looking for, the other 119 that got sold at that particular Costco in Napa. As the Ag Commissioner in Napa County said, 101 is pretty good, but not good enough. We're looking for 100%. In Sonoma County, out of 634 grapevines that were shipped to Costco outlets in Santa Rosa and Rohnert Park, so if you're listening in those areas, they've only been able to track, they've tracked down a lot of them, but they haven't tracked down 100. So of 634, there's 100 that they still have not accounted for. The message is, quote, "We've had a good response, but we need to get the word out even more." This is an Ag Commissioner in Sonoma County. If you purchased a staked grapevine from Costco anywhere in Northern California between April 21 and May 21, keep the plant in its original pot away from other plants. Do not put it in the ground if you have not already done so. If possible, put it inside two trash bags, one inside the other, and seal them closed. Do not return it, transport it, or relocate it at all. Do not place it in the trash or the compost bin. Call the Ag Commissioner. Agricultural Commissioner's Office phone number is readily obtainable. This is a county office. and an ag inspector will come to examine the plant and nearby host plants, and very likely they'll take it away and destroy it. So the full scope of this problem is coming into focus, and regrettably, about 11,000 grapevines went out to Costco stores all over Northern California in 24 counties identified by the California Department of Food and Agriculture. And they do note that if your county doesn't have a Costco, it's got to be some that don't, there would be people travel from those counties to shop at Costco. It's a destination retailer, so people will drive long distances to shop at Costco. So if you are in another county and you drove in and you bought one from a Costco, please, please, please call your local county agricultural commissioner. Lake County is a good example. So they're trying to track them all down. They're trying to deal with this. It is a major, major problem, but they have a process of contact tracing and they know where they came from. They know where they went, at least in terms of the retailers. Now they're asking the public, please, if you bought a grapevine from a Costco in Northern California, in April or May, call the ag commissioner in your county.
So you said what to do if it was still in the pot and you hadn't put it in the ground. If you have put it in the ground, you still call the ag commissioner so they can come and inspect it, right?
That's correct. And the results of their tracing activities have not been, as they put here, entirely encouraging. In Napa County, for example, they've taken samples from 5 egg clusters that were found on vines sold by Costco, sent them to a state lab, and 4 of them came back positive. So 4 of those vines were infested with glassy wing sharpshooter. Sonoma County, they found 1 vine infested with the nymph stage of glassy wing sharpshooter. So they're finding them. They're finding them on the plants that have gone out, and they really need the public's help on this. Just wanted to bring this again. Tragic situation for this nursery down in the Fresno area, but especially big, big, big concern to part of our agriculture, but also for home gardeners. Just so you know, this particular pest has more than 300 host species.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. So when this first showed up, I was on the State Nursery Association Board of Directors in 1990 to 2002, and that's when it showed up. And when they passed around the host list, I remember, you know, there's 20 plus directors, and I was going, that was what you heard. Oh my God. Everyone's going down the list, realizing it's everything, pretty much. I mean, the host list is quite extensive. Except tomatoes, correct. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of woody plants that are on this. And so it would be a big issue for nurseries. It would be a big issue for home gardeners. And particularly, if you happen to have grapevines, it transmits a disease that plugs up the vascular tissue of the plant and causes it to die looking like it needs water. And in some of the winery districts in Southern California, when this first showed up, Temecula area, for example, my recollection is they were losing 20 to 25% of their grapevines in the vineyards. And it was a gradual process. So they were essentially going in, doing rapid testing for the disease, which was the first thing that came out, was a rapid test system, and just ripping them out, planting new ones, rip them out, plant new ones, spray, spray, spray. So it increases pesticide usage considerably if this pest gets further extended in Northern California. Hard to say what will actually come up from this, but for now, if you happen to have a grapevine from one of those places, please call your ag commissioner. We'll keep you updated, folks. Don't worry.
From the mailbag, we have a message from Henry. That's the fellow in Michigan.
Yep.
And he says, I have a ground cover of phlox in my front bed. I have had that ground cover for over 6 years. And the last couple of years, it does flower in the spring, but it doesn't seem as much as it used to.
Yeah.
I read online that if you cut back 30 to 50% of this ground covering right after it's done flowering to rejuvenate the plant to get better flowering next year and beyond. I just wanted to get your opinion about that. Will it help at all? Or am I better off just ripping it out and planting new phlox plants so I get tons of flowers again? What are your thoughts?
Phlox is a big group. Phlox subulata is the one that he's referring to here. It's the ground cover form of phlox, which, just for the record, in our area blooms in February, late January and February. This is not phlox paniculata, the summer phlox that has fragrant flowers on a plant that stands upright. So he's talking about the ground cover form of phlox. Our area, this is typically a 3 to 4 year plant. There's a lot of plants in this category where they're herbaceous, but they get soft wooded over time. And if they get a lot of soft wood building up on the inside, or in the case of a ground cover form, you know, down below what you see under the mat that's on the ground, they can tend to die out. They tend to start blooming further out at the end of the plant. So let's say you buy a 1 gallon ground cover phlox and you plant it 2 to 3 years in, it's going to be a couple feet across. It'll mostly be a ring of flowers on the edge. And that will keep happening further and further out. So the general recommendation in our area, they usually don't live long enough to keep them going that much longer. But where you are in the cold climate, this plant seems to have a good long lifespan. Standard recommendation always is cut it back 50% after blooming. And I do think that that stimulates new growth from the interior of the plant, reduces the woody buildup, and probably would rejuvenate it and keep it blooming better and longer for you. So I do think the pruning in this case would probably make the difference that you're after. It's a little tricky. This is not something where you're going to be carefully pruning individual branches. You're mostly going to put on a pair of gloves, pull up the mat, take kitchen shears, would probably be better than actual pruners in this case, and just going to kind of cut the whole thing back in a bowl haircut, trim the top off a little bit, and right at the start of your season, which I believe is just begun up there, go ahead and cut it back now. You should get some new growth on it pretty quickly. Right after bloom would be better because you could enjoy the bloom and then prune it back. Here, I would be cautious about hard pruning going into hot weather. But in our case, since they bloom in February, you could cut them back in March and that would rejuvenate them very nicely.
So if he has an entire yard full of this stuff, my guess is that it isn't just one plant, that there's a bunch of plants out there. What would you think about going and finding one of the plants and ripping it out and then planting a new one in that hole?
Well, that's what we would do.
But not all of them, just, you know, here and there. Mm-hmm. And then next year, do a few others here and there and replace it that way.
If it's gotten overgrown to the point where there's just not that much bloom and you can tell there's a lot of woody stuff in there, personally, I'd be inclined to pull it all back and cut it back pretty hard and see if it resprouts, because many of these kinds of perennials will resprout from even a very hard pruning. So that's what I would do first, but popping in a new one wouldn't be, it would certainly be an option as well. We have a lot of perennials that are soft wooded, like lavender is a good example. It's more of a shrub, but 3 to 5 years is often considered their lifespan. With strategic, rather savvy pruning, you can get them to go much, much longer and still remain attractive. But it's a matter of, as I can, we call it rejuvenation pruning, where you're trying to get new growth coming from down inside the plant from points that have otherwise been covered over and therefore won't grow. So you're just trying to open up to get the sunlight into some of those growing points down further in towards the crown of the plant.
Gaynor writes, hi there. I have some daffodils to store until planting again in a couple of pots in the fall. Can I store them in a paper bag in an outdoor storage shed? I read in the Sunset Garden book that I should store them flat so they don't touch each other. That would not be easy. So I'm hoping you can, that they can be mingling in a bag.
Well, they could rot. That one, they, you don't want the bulbs touching each other. That's the main thing. And any bulbs that are in storage, whether it's onions that you're going to eat or daffodils or tulips or whatever that you're storing for another time, it's better if they're simply not touching. So if you don't have a place, I would always spread them out on a nursery flat, you know, so they weren't touching. That worked fine, but it's a little awkward. If you have to put them in a bag, typically they would be thrown in with something that will absorb excess moisture. So it can be as simple as wood shavings that we've received them from our bulb suppliers, you know, packed in wood rice hulls. One time I remember that. You just want them not to be touching, because if one bulb rots, you know, the thing about one bad apple can ruin the whole bin. One bulb rotting can ruin the whole thing pretty quickly. And while we don't have constant moisture here, it's not as much of a risk for us. It is still an issue if you're hanging them in your garage, or she said, let's see, in the, where is she going to put them?
In the outdoor shed. Yeah.
Which will be pretty warm, but it'll be pretty dry. So I'm not too concerned about them, but it's better if the bulbs are literally not touching. That's all. I've seen onions stored in pantyhose. So this is true. People who have like Walla Wallas, they want to store them into the winter. They drop one down into the bottom of these used pantyhose, presumably. They put a little quick knot. They drop another one in, put a little quick knot, and so forth. So they're simply not touching.
We finally had the big 40-foot-year-old birch shading most of our little yard from the south cut down last week. This is causing some of my shade-loving plants to burn or even die. I will pull them out and think about what to plant in their place. So far, it is a fern type unknown and begonias. It is unfortunate, but that birch was messy, shaded some of our solar panels, and the roots had taken over our backyard.
For the fern, it would be important to know the type, because some ferns can take more sun. Begonias can take some sun. You just have to look at the spot and see whether they'll get shaded in the afternoon. I have big, interesting begonias, Rex types and cane types, where they get full morning sun, they're just shaded from about 11 to 12 on. So if you can manage to get them a little further over, say, next to the west fence, then perhaps they'll be sufficiently protected there. When you suddenly take out a tree, you have a whole lot of plants that have grown in the shade of that tree that have thinner leaves, thinner leaf coating. This is the important part. More tender open growth, the growth will stretch more, so there's the sunlight will penetrate further into the plant, and it's a very abrupt transition. It would have been great if this tree could have been taken out, let's say, in the fall or midwinter, but it's been taken out right before hot weather. So that sudden change with thinner leaves and direct sun on leaves that were not getting direct sun, they're going to scorch. There's no question about that.
Well, you were talking earlier about protecting your tomato plants by putting a couple of stakes and some shade cloth on the west side. Yeah. In this case, you could do the same thing on the west and south, couldn't you? If they're short little plants.
Yeah, and in this case, you could even put the shade over them because these are plants that prefer shade. So what I was saying earlier was don't do this to your vegetable garden. It'll reduce your yield. Well, your begonia and your ferns would love to have 50% shade. Most nurseries that you go into have large areas with shade cloth. Mm-hmm. Even over plants that prefer full sun, because in nurseries, we're watering them once, twice, three times a day, depending on the weather, and they look better if they get a little bit of shade. So from a retail standpoint, we'll put 30% or 50% shade over even sun-loving plants. 50% shade cloth, which you can buy at hardware stores and such, is something you could put over them, or as we mentioned earlier, to the west of them to shade them from the hottest sun of the day. The only thing is, these are going to be in sun, you know, going forward. Some of them will adapt to that. Some of them, like the begonia, might be fine. It'll just look burnt. That'll be a quick cosmetic injury. Could be pretty severe, but quick cosmetic injury. I've seen this on Japanese maples, for example, when a tree that was protecting them is cut down. Well, the leaves that are there will scorch. Almost immediately, new growth will come out, typically.
And the new leaves will be better adapted to sun.
They'll grow into sun and they will have the thicker leaf coating. Now, there's some varieties of Japanese maples that will just fry again and again and again. So in our area, I don't sell or recommend the thread leaf types because they're thinner leaf and they burn. But blood good maple, Sangukaku, some of the other fairly popular of the regular Japanese maples will adapt to more sun. I'm not going to tell you that they're full sun trees, but you know what? There are three of them now planted in front lawns on one of the main streets in Dixon that goes between Highway 113 and where I shop. And so I'll go by these. I've been going by these trees now for 20, 30 years. And what in the case of one of them, for whatever reason, these folks went to a nursery, bought a regular old red leaf Japanese maple and put it out in front in their lawns. And I have to say,
nobody told them not to.
Right?
Nobody told the trees that they couldn't grow. So they did.
They did, and they don't look bad, at least driving by. You know, I know that if I walked up, which probably I shouldn't do, but if I walked up and started looking at the leaves very closely and they came out to ask me what I was doing, I would say, I was just checking to see if these leaves are scorched on the west side. Don't worry, folks, I'll back off now. Everything is fine. But they look okay. And so it's kind of funny to see three regular old red leaf Japanese maples in full sun. I think the key thing here is they're in lawns. They're getting watered with the lawn.
Lots of water.
And they probably during extreme heat, you know, don't look that great, but they're tolerating what is, I would call it, way more sun than I would ever recommend for a Japanese maple. So it can be done. They can grow into the situation. I'd be concerned about the fern. I'd be less concerned about the begonia. The thing would be, if these are plants of value and you want to move them, they should move quite readily. That wouldn't be too difficult.
You want to wait till fall to move them?
You want to wait till milder weather. Personally, I would just wait till we're back in the Delta breeze. This is we've had this conversation over the last few days with a lot of people. They'll be buying vegetables or they'll be buying, you know, plants for their border and they want to know, should I wait? Should I hold them till fall? No, don't hold them till fall. Now, this birch tree belonged to the neighbors. I remember this discussion 10 plus years ago. And finally, you know, these folks put on solar panels on their house. This tree was to the south of them. And it finally grew up to the point where it was actually casting shadow on their solar panels, which is a common conflict between houses. You can't really top a birch tree readily. It just doesn't work. They would have loved to have the neighbor take out the birch tree, but the neighbors liked their birch tree. So they simply lost the value of their solar panels. And that's where it kind of stands with respect to the laws and regulations in California at this time. But now that it's come out, they're going to have a lot more sun. They could put in a small tree, just making sure that it's something that will never get big enough to shade the solar panels. And we have lots of options in that. I'll just throw out Acer truncatum. Shantung maple. Looks like a Japanese maple, but takes full sun. Lovely spreading growth habit. So while it could get to 20 to 30 feet, it's very easy 5 years in to just take the center out and have it look basically like a large Japanese maple. That's one. It's not a particularly low water tree, but it's more drought tolerant than Japanese maple. That would shade over your plants that are in there. The only question is whether they can wait long enough. Plenty of other tree possibilities for this. Depends on what you want to look at. You know, if you have a citrus there, my recollection there is or was a lime and an orange in this backyard. Maybe prune that up a little bit more and have it become more tree-like and have it sort of replace the shade value that you were getting from the birch tree. Those are all possibilities. Anything that will shade it from the west is the key thing we're looking at. Morning sun, even for plants that prefer shade, is perfectly benign. You can have full sun on a fern at 10 in the morning. It won't be a problem. That same fern, 4 o'clock afternoon sun, the leaves will burn real badly.
All right. Now back to Gaina's message. She had one, a third item here. She said, I would like to cut back a few bushes, and I'm afraid of damaging them. One is Philadelphus mock orange, mm-hmm. and the other, I don't know the name, so I'm attaching a photo.
All right,
let's talk about Philadelphus, because that's one of my favorite bushes in the world. And I got to tell you, you can prune it any way you want. You won't.
Much. It's a deciduous flowering shrub, which was a category of landscape plant that I had zero experience with until I moved up here because it didn't grow them in San Diego. Flowering quince, Philadelphus, forsythias, things like that, spireas, I hardly knew about any of those. General rule is you just prune them right after the bloom. And you can prune them any way you want, but basically it's size control is what most people are doing. With Philadelphus in particular, which is the East Coast mock orange. We also have a West Coast native Philadelphus. They bloom in the spring. It's April, May. It's got the wonderful smell of lemon blossoms, and then they're done. It's a once a year bloom. Same thing.
It's a long bloom, though.
It's long, 4 or 5 weeks. Yeah, and it goes on, and it's a lovely background smell. The flowers are white, so they're not jumping out at you showy, but the fragrance is great, and the plants generally are large and rather arching. So a single Philadelphus grown to its full potential would probably be about a 10 by 10 sprawling shrub. There are dwarfer varieties, so that's one thing to look for if you have a smaller yard. But more to the point, you can control the size very, very readily without cutting into the bloom as long as you just prune them right after the bloom. Don't prune them in the winter. This goes for almost any deciduous flowering shrub and many deciduous flowering trees. You're only growing them for the bloom. Lady Banks rose, a vine that's in the same category. You wait till the bloom is done. You go ahead and cut them back as hard as you want. Then they'll sprout back out. And the Philadelphus I've seen done two ways. One is shear it like a hedge. I don't know why people do that, but they do it. If you do that once a year right after the bloom, okay, it'll bush out and it'll be, dense and sort of hedge-like. Much more attractive to me is just branches that are too long, shorten them up a couple feet. Branches that are crossing and rubbing, thin those out. In other words, more artistic, sort of selective pruning on them. But also for size control, if you don't want it to get 8 feet plus, shorten them down to an existing branch if you possibly can. You won't hurt the plant. You can even cut it down to 12 inches from the ground if you want to. It'll sprout right back up and it'll still bloom the next year as long as you don't do that too late in the season or during the winter time. If you happen to be going out to buy a Philadelphus, look for, dwarf Minnesota snowflake. That one gets 3 feet. That is virginalis. That is a cultivar of virginalis. Minnesota snowflake gets 6 to 8 feet. Natchez is in the 6 foot range. There's one called Glacier that's 3 to 4 feet. So there are dwarf versions of the East Coast mock orange. And there's even a dwarf version of the, a double flowered compact version of the West Coast Philadelphus called Goose Creek, which has double flowers.
And the last question is, she said, I'm attaching a photo because I don't know the name of the bush. What is it, Don?
Abelia. A-B-E-L-I-A, Abelia. So the question was whether it could be pruned, I guess, and whether it should be pruned given the sudden change in sunlight. Abelia grandiflora or Abelia Edward Goucher, those are the two most common in the trade. There are some others. They've been around for ages. It's one of my favorite shrubs for just a green background plant that has pretty flowers on it pretty much all the time. Hummingbirds like them. They especially like Edward Goucher, but I've also seen them going to grandiflora. It has an arching growth habit. It's informal. It's in the honeysuckle family, but it's not rampant like a running honeysuckle. It's a shrub, and it can be clipped. It can be pruned informally. You can prune it anyway you want. You can thin it out, which is what I was doing once when I was working on an estate in San Diego. I was carefully pruning the abelias to make them look more natural because someone had sheared them. So my job now is to go in and unshear them. Very commonly in commercial landscapes, maintenance gardeners will clip these as if they were boxwood. I think that looks horrible, but the plant is fine with it. So you can do that if you want to do that. So if the question is, can abelia take full sun? Absolutely. Can you prune them any way you want? Absolutely. If you cut it back really hard, you'll get a bunch of, this is what I was doing at this estate, cutting them back to, you know, 12 inches from the ground, but also thinning them out at the same time. It'll arch out and make a very elegant, attractive shrub. And it blooms off and on all the time. To me, the plant has a naturally elegant, attractive growth habit that you should accentuate, but a lot of people like to clip them. It will probably scorch briefly. And this is a plant that would almost certainly recover right away from the sudden change from considerable shade to considerable sun. So it's a great choice in that regard.
Mm-hmm. So I am going to go to Kara, who said, I love listening to your show every week and would appreciate some advice for my garden in Sacramento. I planted a bay tree pretty close to the house, 2 feet or so, about 8 years ago. My intent was to keep it pretty small, and I have always pruned the branches back so they're no taller than the eaves of my single-story house. I've noticed in the last 1 to 2 years, this tree really wants to take off and grow vigorously. I can keep pruning it as I always have, but I'm wondering if the root system so close to the house will be a problem in the future. I think the tree would look beautiful if it were allowed to stretch its branches, and wondered how practical or successful it would be to transplant it in the winter or fall, of course. The caliper of the largest trunk is about 5 inches. Okay. Just curious as to what you would do in my situation. Remove it because of the root issue? Remove it and attempt to transplant it? Keep it heavily pruned where it is? I've attached some photos in case that helps.
Yes, this is a bay, Laurus nobilis, our native, not our native, the non-native bay, the Mediterranean bay laurel, which is a 40 to 50 foot tree that is able to get a trunk as much as 2 to 3 feet in diameter over many years. So obviously, in the very long term, it's way too close to the house. And it is a big plant, and I'm concerned about this proximity. 2 feet from the house with a bay tree is just not going to go more than 5 or 10 more years. It's not an emergency, but you definitely will want to remove this ultimately. You can prune it hard for that time.
It doesn't stop the growth of the trunk, though.
No, the trunk will keep getting thicker and thicker. The biggest bay tree I'm aware of was taken out a couple of years ago. It was over on Plum Lane. It had been planted in the 1940s, so it was a good 70, 80 years old. It was about 50 feet tall, and it had a trunk about 3 feet in diameter. And after all, it was an amazing specimen, by the way. It was really a shame that it had to go. But after all those years, it finally developed a heart rot. An arborist looked at it. It was between two houses. They just felt it wasn't safe to leave it there. So it's way too big for that situation. Bay trees can be planted in a lot of situations sort of temporarily. Like big urns, containers, some ways where you're going to prune them, fine. But this close to the house does concern me.
So this is, I'm looking at the pictures. Thank you for the pictures. That always helps.
Yeah.
And it's in a little planting strip between the house and a wide sidewalk. So they put it in the middle of this little planting strip. That's the problem, I think, is that they don't have room for it. Now, if you went across the sidewalk to the other side, that would be over towards the fence and it might actually work. Don, it's too big to replant.
I would get this question all the time with someone wanting to move a plant or buy a mature tree or something. Hypothetically, you can dig up and move anything. I would expect that if I were going to move this, if I were estimating it on as a landscaper, I would figure 6 to 8 labor hours just because you're going to have to prune it back. You're going to have to excavate around it. You're going to have to dig up as much of the root ball as you can, the equivalent of about a 15-gallon to 24-inch box size root ball. And that's only going to be a percentage of it, but that at least would be enough to get you started.
Kill the bushes around.
You will damage the shrubs that are in the bed. Yeah, it looks like those are mostly fairly easily.
And rosemary.
Yeah, I think they could. In fact, you probably wouldn't even kill them. You would just trample them and trim them back when you're done, and they'd fill right back in. They'd be perfectly happy. I would try and move it just because you're going to have to take it out anyway, and I would think that would be a fun project. You'd be cutting it back severely. Fun. The good news is bay trees have growth buds all the way down to the ground. So you could cut this plant back to 4 feet. Let's say it's October and you've decided you're going to try and save it. Trim away the rosemary to, so that you can get in with a shovel, a nice nursery spade would be ideal for this, honestly. About 18 inches out, start cutting straight down. And a lot of times you'll get a sense pretty quickly about how easy the project is going to be. Because if you're cutting through a fair number of smaller roots and the person who's helping you is just sort of rocking the plant a little bit, you'll begin to notice when it starts to loosen enough that you're going to be able to dig it out. If you're not hitting a bunch of big roots, mostly smaller roots and a pretty good network of them, there's a really good chance this thing will move. Their growth buds are there ready to go. Going into rainy season would be just ideal in terms of moving it. So October to early November in our climate would work best. And then just water really carefully when it first warms up and starts to get dry next March or April. So if you want to save this plant, it could be done. It wouldn't be that hard to do. You're essentially moving the stump and as much of the roots as you can dig out, and you'd have a bay tree to put somewhere else. And allowed to grow to their full potential, they're a glorious tree. This is a plant that's typically pruned hard by people. It's a great hedge plant for screening, all that kind of thing. But if you can put it in a place where it can get 30, 40 feet and grow to its full potential, birds love bay trees. The density is great for jays and mockingbirds, for example. So it might be worth keeping it if there's a place in the yard where you could let it grow and wouldn't have to prune it all the time.
What I'm thinking is if you cut this down, you know, to a couple feet tall and going to have it resprout and go up again, why not just plant a new one?
Well, yeah,
in the new place? Because if it's grow, if it's starting from that much shortness, a new one, you could have it grow and not look stumped.
Yes, that's
true. That'd be weird.
Yeah, commonly when I get this question, my assumption is that they just want to save the plant for one reason or another. Certainly, planting a new 5-gallon bay tree would be a lot easier than what we're describing here. But I do think it would move. It's not so big that it's impossible. And I do think that it should move, but it's not an emergency. So that's the point. You could keep it there for years, but I would hate to see you leave it there. 20 years from now, it'd just be too big for the spot. And it would turn out to be a lot of pruning because it is kind of under the overhang. So you're having to prune it away from that. Lots of great shrubs you could put in this spot. You could move the bay out to where it could get bigger. Some place you need privacy, for example. One of the cool things about bay laurel is that I had a customer recently who was fairly recently dealing with a two-story building that went in next to them, which hadn't been there before. Yeah, you'll remodel and suddenly there's a big thing up there and there was a window in it. That wasn't the big issue, but the big issue was suddenly that thing was in the view. Well, a bay tree will make a nice screen about 6 feet wide, 20 to 30 feet tall, right straight out where you want it. So it's one of those plants where you're trying to screen off just one particular awkward view. It fits great. It does the job better than Italian cypress or any of the other really upright evergreens you might be thinking of. And they're very, very prunable. So you can top it down if that's going to be too tall for you or the neighbors. You can trim it in if you have a narrow garden. They're very, very malleable as far as landscape uses go.
Except for the trunk.
Yeah, the trunk gets big. It's a tree. Yeah. And so that is why we would prefer to see it out where it has room to develop. I'm concerned about the roots. I'm concerned about the size of the trunk in that spot eventually.
And it also depends on how energetic the person is. In other words, at 20 years ago, I might have tried moving something like that. Now, that sucker's coming out.
You pay someone who's 20 years younger is what you do now. That's
I'm afraid that's it. Yeah.
We once dug out on our farm here a mulberry tree, my kid and I, and it was a very useful experience. It was a mulberry that had been planted where I did not want a mulberry tree.
They have horrible roots.
And it was 10 feet from our septic. I mean, seriously, it was a really bad choice. And I didn't put it there. So we knew we had to dig it out because we wanted to plant something in that area. It took my kid and I 4 to 6 hours. And the kid was a young teenager, so not fully, not working at full potential, but there. And it was a pretty big job. You're cutting roots, you're rocking the thing.
You were killing the tree, right?
We could have moved it had we wished to do so, but yes, we were intending to kill it. We wanted to dig it out completely. But the key thing here was the number of hours it took, 4 to 6 hours. That became a really useful data point for me going on when we went into landscaping. Someone would say, can you dig out that oleander? I'd go, yeah, sure, 6 hours of labor, or we can just cut it down and be done with it that way. But digging it out was going to be several hours of labor. So if it's something you want to keep, you're going to put a few hours into it. If something you want to get rid of, you cut it down in a totally different manner, and it doesn't take nearly as long.
All right. Don sent me this article. Actually, it's a website. And D period, A period, M period, N period. And you can pronounce it yourself. Yeah. Good Lavender Farm and Apiary. And this is it's fairly new. They opened in 2019, but it's up here near Woodland. Don, tell me about this. I haven't been there.
This showed up on my email, and I'm happy to mention that there's a U-Pick Lavender Farm right west of Woodland. U-Pick Lavender. You go up there, you pay a certain amount of money, you can pick a bouquet of lavender or a whole bunch of lavender. It's the D-A-M-N, Good Lavender Farm and Apiary. And as I say, they're west of Woodland, and they're having their lavender days right now. And I wanted to mention this because wherever you are, there's probably, if you're in a relatively dry climate and even some rainier climates, there may be a U-Pick lavender farm. And this is a wonderful thing to go visit. I mean, you can see all the bees and the butterflies going through them. You can look at the different types, and they're generally very mellow places out in the country. So I wanted to mention this one that's local here, but wherever you are, there's a pretty good chance. Their next upcoming days are June 12th in the evening, an evening in the lavender, Saturday, Sunday, June 13th and 14th during the daytime lavender days to visit and smell the lavender and pick some for a fee. Lavender Days 2026 at the DAMN Good Lavender Farm west of Woodland. Easy to find. Just type that into your Google search engine and you can find them. And it's about 5 minutes west of Woodland where you can go pick some lavender.
And if you don't like abbreviations, that's Dan, Alex, Michelle, and Nicole. So, no, I'm serious. I'm reading their about page, and that's how they came up with their name. It's the acronyms for the four people in the family, and it's a good lavender farm.
Okay, we're having fun with this because we're always warned as we do these shows about FCC regulations about saying certain words and not saying certain words. I don't think saying the word damn on the air is going to make the FCC crack down on us, but I was raised by a mother with Midwestern sensibilities.
Yes.
She's also a person with Midwestern sensibilities.
Instead of anything else.
Right. My mother, when very angry, would say, O-H. That was what she would say because she was a proper woman. So you can go to the damngoodlavenderfarm.com and check out their lavender picking days.
Yeah.
So something interesting to do if you go to these places and you're interested in lavender, look at how they're growing them. Notice they have a lovely picture here, by the way. They've got drip, which is great for lavender. And there's a very slight elevation for each row of lavender. Mm-hmm. Lavender is one of those plants.
They're mounded.
They're mounded up a little bit. It looks like about 6 inches from the picture. So the crown of the plant is about 6 inches above the grade around it. So even when it's raining and there's water flooding across this field, it won't stand around the crown of the lavender. That's probably the most important thing you need to know about growing lavender. Lavender thrives here in the Sacramento Valley. But the key is they're susceptible to crown rot. And so if you're planting lavender anywhere that's hot and dry and you have fairly dense soils, just elevate it. That's the key thing. It's very easy to grow as long as water drains away from the crown.
And the quote for this week is, love a flower and share your information with other people.
You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore
and Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.